This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Welcome to The Limits. I'm Jay Williams. Let me take you back, way, way, way back. It's the year 1993, and I'm a teenager shooting hoops in my own backyard. Wu-Tang Clan's 36 Chambers, man, I love that album. It's blaring in my Walkman. As I'm about to take a shot, RZA's voice stops me dead in my tracks. You see, those words hit, not just for me, but for an entire generation. The Wu-Tang Clan changed hip-hop music and me forever. You see, as an athlete, you have to believe you're the best. Yeah, you can go out and practice, you can put in the work, but at the end of the day, if you don't think you're gonna make it, you never will. It's the same in hip-hop. When RZA founded the Wu-Tang Clan, along with Raekwon, Ghostface Killah, Old Dirty Bastard, and the rest of the Wu-Tang MCs, man, I just love saying their names, it gives you that vibe, doesn't it? He believed they were going to be the best, the very best. 30 years later, his music still sits at the very top of the best of hip-hop. He reached the pinnacle. But once you reach the top, where do you go from there? For RZA, he never stopped pushing himself and hip-hop. He even has a new album out called Saturday Afternoon Kung Fu Theater. And he's one of the very first to ever think about what it means to be an elder statesman of hip-hop and creating generational wealth. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me slow down. Here's my conversation with the legendary hip-hop producer, RZA. It's a pleasure to meet you, brother. I got to tell you, man, I can't tell you how many times I've recited your lyrics as a 13-year-old kid shoveling the snow outside in Jersey. So much respect and love to everything you've accomplished in your life, man. You are king among kings, man. So much respect and love first and foremost.
Thank you, Jay. I appreciate that. I'm glad that anything that we did artistically resonated with you and made your day better or cooler or whatever. You know what I mean? So thank you, too.
I got to ask you, RZA, like, when I make mentions of names like Jay Dilla, Kanye, Just Blaze, Pete Rock, Dr. Dre, DJ Premier, Timberland, Eric B., yourself, like, did you ever think that you would be in that rarefied air as one of the greatest hip-hop producers of all time?
You know, you don't know, right? You have an instinct when you're trying to approach art, and especially hip-hop, which is a very competitive form of art. You have an instinct that you can be great. You know, as an MC, you feel like you're the best MC. You have this, you know, even MC Hammer said he's the best MC, you know what I mean? Because It's a confidence needed, you know? And then when it came to me as a producer, what I did know was that my approach to it was purely from hip-hop and not really from other aspects of music. What I mean by that is some producers, you know, you could say their sound was jazz. It's hip-hop, but you hear a lot of jazz samples, funk samples, James Brown samples. And I wanted to try to create something that, even if it was samples, it only could be identified as hip-hop. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I didn't want to get bracketed like, in the beginning, he's making a new style of jazz. He's making a new style of funk. I just wanted to be hip-hop and not R&B, not reggae, nothing, you know? And so I think with that intention, it allowed me to definitely carve a piece of it out, you know what I mean?
It's like your sound is so distinct, though. I read something, and obviously this brings it all the way back to 1993, your debut with Enter the Wu-Tang, right? Which I go back to the album when I was 13 years old. That it was so descriptive, man. It blew me away about how I looked at you, because it said the outlook was eccentric and encyclopedic, drawing on esoteric knowledge, comic books, street lore, Chopsocky films, crime stories, black nationalism, martial arts, and chess. And Riz, like, I think, like, I'm into chess. I'm into martial arts. I'm into Chopsocky films. Like, can you describe to me where that distinct sound or where the origination of that thought process came from for you?
Well, they say the child you are is what makes you the man you become. And so all of these childhood loves, the ones all you just listed right there, and then the technological ability to play with turntables and play with four tracks and put sounds together, right? So I was, you know, I started first without a sampler, right? We had a four track tape recorder and a drum machine, and you'll just, you know, cut the beat first, whatever drum loop you wanted to cut. Then you'll find other records and go on top of it. And the things I would put on top would be so obscure. I took Screaming Jay Hawkins, My God.
Yes.
But then I took Wild Man Steve, the comedian, got something from him. And then I got some Peter Pan record that was like Peter Pan played by the Philadelphia Orchestra or something like that. You know what I mean? And I would just cut another one in, cut another sound in. And when the crew heard it on the streets, you know, people back in those days just get your tape and dub it. They was playing it in the Jeeps. It was like the neighborhood hit of the summer. Mm. And I was the man, you know what I mean? And so I continued down that path. And then when I got a sampler, you know, when I got that SB-1200, it gave me the power now to manipulate, to chop, and to put all these different ingredients together. And I think I put the most weirdest ingredients together because I'm looking at, you know, a comic. I'm looking at a kung fu movie. I'm playing chess in the streets. I'm living the street life, trying to survive. And all that, you know, the grittiness of New York, that's what's in my head. I'm capturing it, you know? We're banging on drums, you know, the engineer recording it in elevator shafts just to get the certain sound that you can't get other places, you know? Just capturing New York. And so I think that is that. I think it's the childhood loves. It's the DJ ability to translate that into the technology of sampling and understanding what that is. And mind you, I did all this, you know, I had no instruction manual, you know? So it was also discovery in the process.
Did that kind of eccentric thinking process, did that make you kind of misunderstood because you saw or heard things differently than how other people saw them? Like, you know, so much of upbringing has to do with, do you fit in? Especially back then, did you feel like you fit in or did you fit out?
That's a good question, Jay. I think I fit in on the surface. Like, so I'm right there in the crew and you know, Alpha as well, and got a lot of students, you know, like I'm good. But the full me fits out because there's still this awkwardness about me, this non-understanding about me that existed. And it only came out, like, if you look at me as an artist, right? And, you know, my manager, he concurred that I'm a great lyricist, and, you know, that's why he signed me. You know, Tommy Boy gave me a record deal. They heard my lyrics and they realized I was saying something very witty and unique and, you know, a good MC. My voice wasn't the normal hip hop voice, nor was my cadence, but it was something there, right? It was something there. Something awkward about it, I think. Not as awkward as De La Soul, because theirs was awkward, but it was still accessible. You know what I mean?
My awkwardness, yes, I do.
Was kind of almost like olive tapenade. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? you got to grow into that taste. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I would say that, so not fitting in at that capacity, but I think that, you know, as an MC, that was the element. But my lyrical content, like all my peers, you know, they thought I was the best. But I always felt that the thing that was hurting me from really shining was that the production that I was seeking from other producers wasn't really accenting me as a lyricist or even the rest of my crew. That's how I felt. So I wanted to make it myself. And it was doubt. You know, a lot of people doubted that what I was doing would be successful, be accepted, because it wasn't as simple as taking Funky Drummer with a bass line and making you dance. If you think about a lot of the Wu-Tang songs, when they come on sometimes, you stop dancing and you start listening.
Listening, exactly. I can't tell you how many times I stopped shoveling or stopped hooping to rewind the tape back to just let me listen. What did he say again? Wow.
Right.
He put it together like that? Like, it stopped you in time.
Right. And that was something that, you know, it was a blessing to be able to do that, I think. I think in the beginning, think of an executive whose job is to have radio hits and club hits that really fits a formula. Here comes a guy without a formula. How does he fit in? And one thing I think people overlooked in that day is that music not only has a rhythm and a groove, but it has a spirit. And sometimes it's the spirit that moves you or that makes you, like I said, stop and listen or whatever it gives you that day, make you clean up your house or drive your car faster or slow it down. You know what I mean? It's not just let's get the party going, you know?
While getting ready for this conversation, I mean, you should have seen me. I was like a little kid in a candy store as I went through those early Wu-Tang records, and I was just in awe. RZA brought together these rappers with completely different styles of rapping and made it work. Just listen to my man Raekwon. Ghostface.
Dwelling in the past, flashbacks when I was young.
GZA.
Hit your blood baths and elevator shafts like these murderers.
RZA listened for what made them unique and let them shine. But he didn't just have an ear for music. He's also a genius strategist, and he had a plan to take these men to number one and beyond. All he asked was for them to let him be their CEO for 5 years. RZA breaks down that plan after a quick break. This is The Limits from NPR. I'm Jay Williams.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply. This message comes from NPR sponsor Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the platform for database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive at oracle.com/NPR.
In this country, more than 2 local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
I feel like so much of who we become is a byproduct of where we came from. So I want to go back a little bit more to your childhood for a second, RZA. So when you were younger and 19 members of your extended family were living in a two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
What did that teach you about family, first and foremost?
I mean, I guess the one thing it taught me was get in where you fit in, right? That's the funny part.
Yeah.
Like, yo, because no, you might not sleep in the same place you slept last night. You know what I mean? But more importantly, yo, I think being around that many people, you know, even having 11 brothers and sisters, coming from a big family, I think it taught me the understanding of personalities. It taught me to be able to navigate personalities. And when I look at the Wu-Tang Clan, which are these are all alpha. These ain't like no chumps. These are dudes that's the alpha, and they got a crew or a bunch of dudes looking up to them. And they're taking, and now, and some of them bigger than me, more muscles, more stronger, more with orders. You know what I mean? But I had this ability to understand personalities and have also an ability of empathy, you know, and that ability of empathy that I got just growing up in my family, it worked and it helped as I'm navigating with my crew.
Did that make you more aware of how you had to bring people together, in particular with the Wu? Or did that leave you any blind spots because you were so empathetic that maybe you tried too much to help people? I heard you described as a imprenario, right? Like an organizer, this guy who's able to bring people together in the best form or fashion. Do you feel like that helped you with your strengths and weaknesses to a degree?
Yeah, I think it's more strength than weakness, because I think the strength of it is the result that it gives to the people you bring together, the result of the product that comes out of that, whether it's some form of art, whether you brought people together to build a home, or whether, you know, you brought people together to start a revolution, whatever. The good is going to outweigh the bad. The weakness of it sometimes falls back upon yourself, which is the expectation that may now arise from people expecting you to be at a certain capacity, you know, yearning and maybe even becoming dependent upon that personality that you obtain. So it could be weakness, and that could hurt you. But I think that's the sacrifice, especially if we're working towards the good.
It just seems like those experiences as a teen really set you up for building out the Wu-Tang Clan. I mean, you brought together 9 rappers and made them into one group. Tell me about the moment you realized your vision for the Wu-Tang. Was it something that just happened, or was it something that grew over time and developed?
Of course it grew over time, because the talent had to grow, right? You know, it takes 10 years to become a master, they say. And I think if you look at, if I'm writing my first lyric at the age of 9, so by the time we formed the Wu-Tang Clan, which is 19 years old, because we actually was talking Wu-Tang at the age of 19, even though we didn't get a chance to share it with the world until 3 years later. It's a process, but the vision of the success that accumulated with the awareness of myself, you know, I can't describe it in words, but it's definitely, it's almost a spine tingling feeling you get when you hear some great music and you feel it all up your back and everything. When I had that, and it was like, if I follow this procedure here, I'm going to make it to number one. You know what I mean? I guess the best way to say it is like to get the inspiration and to motivate yourself and move with a determined idea. So determined, you can't be deterred. Nothing was going to stop me. Nobody could even talk me out of it. It's like, I guess I didn't know that then, but I can say this now. I guess when the Holy Quran says, like, who's going to make it to paradise? It don't say, you know, the Christians or the Jews or the Muslims. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? Or the Hindus. It says the believers. You know what I mean? Those who believe 100% in the aspects of that destination. And so that 100%, because believing is sometimes, to believe could be defined to agree without knowing, right? But when you truly believe, you actually know. When you truly believe, it's not believing without knowing. You believe it because you know. You know that 5 fingers is here and 5 fingers is here, and I got 10. And nobody's going to tell me that it's 20 or 8. I know it. I believe it, and I know it. It becomes one and the same. And I have that determined idea in me at that age. And I just saw it, and I couldn't be deterred from it. And I shared it with my brothers, and they agreed, you know what I mean? And whether they knew it or not didn't matter, because sometimes a scientist has the equation and the other scientists don't know it yet, but they trust that he's been on it for a long time. So the chances of him being right is really based on the faith of him, right? And then as time goes on, he proves that equation. And so I asked my crew to give me 5 years of their life in a dictatorship mentality, and we're going to get to number one. And at the 5-year mark, number one album in the world, Wu-Tang Forever.
And you call that 5-year plan, right? And that's essentially that's where that moment occurred where you released an album as a group and then you release individual albums. That's so surgical. You built a brand and you amplified the individual brands in the overall larger group brand.
Yes. And consciously. And that's only going for what? Doing the knowledge. I knew that GZA had, you know, I know him and I know that colleges would accept him. I know that he's the type of guy, his way he thinks is academic in nature. It's lyrical, his flow is all great, but also, you know, and as he evolved, he's now speaking, helping science get back in schools and going to colleges and speaking. But he was already that then, and I saw that. I know Raekwon and Ghost was strictly, you know, I knew all the gangsters were gonna love them. They were gangsters. You know what I mean? It was real. And the voice of that generation of gangsters wasn't on your radio. It wasn't on your TV set. You know what I mean? And I don't mean just gangster, just blah, 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 blah. But I mean like just dudes who just, you know, that's just super real if the cause was needed. You know what I mean? And I knew that a lot of people out there was going to relate to that. Even though Meth wasn't intentionally wanted to be a sex symbol, you know, because he was a rough dude, but nah, he was a sex symbol at the end of the day. You know what I mean? It's like he couldn't hide that, even though he, you know, he tried to get away from it, but nah. It's just like, yo, the women and children is gonna come more running to you. And you know what? When this album came out of all of us, he was the one that had the limousine chases. The whole, you know what I mean? Like people chasing the limousine. And I saw it, you know what I mean? I saw it.
When you were in the studio while you guys were recording this, did you recognize at that moment that this was potentially going to be the greatest hip hop album of all time?
I would say I just recognized that this was definitely going to be great and different and was definitely going to exist, you know, in the canon. You know, I don't want to be too egotistical, but I guess it's the greatest hip hop album of all time. But I knew the Wu-Tang Clan were the best. You know what I mean? I knew it. I like, this is, we are the best right now. And we're the best because, look, what makes us the best is hip-hop itself born this. Like, it born all the other great hip-hoppers. At one point, it was undeniable that Rakim was the best. It was undeniable. He was born out of hip-hop. He did it, and he approached, when we heard it, it was like, yo, that's great. It's not good. It's great. When Big Daddy Kane, you know, when he did that demo with Biz Markie, and we heard him, it's the Kane in the flesh. Of course I'm fresh. You thought that I was rhyming. I bet. When he came in with that rhyming with Biz, and it just played on the radio, when we heard it, it was like, yo, that's great. You know what I mean? And the same thing goes back to the GZA, Method Man, Raekwon, Ghost, you know what I mean? When I was just hearing them in my community, when they just coming to my crib and making demos, I was like, yo, that's great. And then to take all of that energy and put it together, that's what makes it, when I say the best, it's like, it ain't just two great MCs or three great MCs or four great MCs or five great MCs. I mean, people don't even talk about Inspector Deck, but Inspector Deck probably wrote some of the greatest hip-hop bars in the game.
Of all time, yes.
Right.
Facts.
You just keep adding on to it. You go, wow, it's just getting greater and greater. And it's a culmination of greatness. You know what I mean? And each one is giving us something, not to keep talking right about the crew, but each one is giving us a perspective and an angle, an approach of hip hop that has a common denominator, but yet it's still different. So we think about You God, Raw, I'm gonna give it to you. With no trivia, Raw like cocaine, straight from Bolivia. My hip hop will rock and shock the nation, like the Emancipation Proclamation. It's like, yo, just that line is so compacted with information and spirit. You know what I mean? And so, and of course, ODB is giving us an energy. His energy still hasn't reemerged yet. You know, like some of us, you may say, oh, you may pit this guy against status. His energy has not reemerged yet. Like, it was only him that had it and nobody else. Singularity have reemerged with that energy. You know, to me, Ye has a spoonful of ODB energy because of his bravery, his expression of pain. ODB also was a very pained artist. you know, the walking on stage, you know, to the Grammys, you see Ye did it himself, right? Mm-hmm. But nobody's singularity has ODB spirit, has not reemerged. You know what I mean?
When you say his name, Rizzo, how does that make you feel?
I mean, I got so much love for him. I'm so grateful that I was able to spend a great chunk of my life with him. He was like, he was, you know, one of my arms at one point. You know what I mean? That's how tight me and were, you know? And so I always feel, you know, like a sense of loss and missing, because it's just like, he's not here to see all these things that we dreamed about and talked about and laid up in the bed until dawn, talking about what we could be and what we could do. And this is like 13, 14. And so definitely something, a life cut short in my opinion. But then there's the part of that I know, like, yo, hey son, you did it though. You rocked the world, you shocked the world, and you left an indelible imprint on this world.
You can hear it there. RZA grappling with legacy, his own and that of the Wu-Tang Clan. After the break, RZA has a new plan for how to turn rappers into rock stars and cash in on the legacies they built. Watch out, Rolling Stones. This is The Limits from NPR. I'm Jay Williams.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Lisa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
Not that this analogy compares at all, RZA, but you know, when I got drafted second, there was a lot of pressure on me because people would say, oh, you're great. You were the second pick in the draft to live up or exceed this expectation. So when you guys came out with, quote unquote, the greatest hip hop album ever, how did you personally deal with the pressure to what's next? How do I make what we just have so different that it's better than what was before? How did you deal with that?
I just think, to be honest with you, Jay, I just keep creating, right? I don't have to repeat what I've done. And if you think about it, some people may argue Liquid Swords is better than it, right? Some people argue Cuban Links is it, you know what I mean? You know, you talk to Pusha T, and his team of Cuban Links is the greatest hip-hop album, right? The point is, though, Cuban Links don't sound like 36 Chambers, you know what I mean? You could tell it's from the same, but it's like, no, it's a different movie. And I think that if you really, when they do go back and check my catalog and start looking at it with a magnifying glass, they'll realize that, yo, even though it's all Wu-Tang, it's so many angles of approach that I took. And that's just how I am. You know what I mean? When I was learning hip hop, there was an MC that was like, I never say the same rhyme twice. Like, I don't know if it was the Fearless Four or was it Cold Crush Brothers, but somebody said that in their lyric, you know, as I'm a young listener. And I took heed to that. I was like, yeah, I'm never going to, you know, make the same beat twice or something. Like, I wanted to, like, never have to run out of it. And, you know, and so every now, you know, of course, as time go on, I may give you another interpretation of a track. There's been, you know, four or five tracks in my career that I think that I reinterpreted, like the track from Tears. I used that record and grabbed another part of it and used it for another song because I always wanted to use that part, but it didn't work in the original song. So I've done that. But majority of the times, I'm always seeking, always digging, always finding ways to express this art and this hip-hop art form.
You know, when you get a chance to see rock artists these days and they're still touring, making millions of dollars, tens of millions, actually, do you feel that the role of an elder statesman of yourself, of hip-hop, is to continue to push that narrative that, like, hey, like, there is an opportunity out here to create generational wealth of knowledge by how you perform?
Yes, I do. And that's what I'm striving to do. So that goes back to, you know, I saw that, you know, I have a lot of rock and roll friends. You know, I was blessed to break bread with them and hang out. And I seen how they, you know, how they do it. And I was trying to tell my brothers, like, we could get on a regimen that will lead to that. And it's like, you know, Bob Marley, I think, Wu-Tang, you know, you go back to rock and roll, you're going to get the Doors, Pink Floyd. There's certain albums and certain things that's like rites of passage. You're going to pass by this in order to get to where you have to get to. Since that is a reality now and it's happening, we did a concert in Long Beach a few weeks ago. Actually, it was just a one-off, but everybody showed up. And the crazy thing is you don't know who's going to show up. You know, you just go. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The audience, though, ranged from, you know, 19-year-olds all the way up to 40-year-olds. You know what I mean? Even 50-year-olds, all there. And I was like, okay. So going back to your thing about do I think it's necessary for me and for the Wu-Tang Clan to continue to tour and share the knowledge and then maybe perhaps gain the wealth of what the music industry offers rock and roll artists and offers, you know, the greats. Yes, I think we should. And I think we should continue. I think it's almost our duty to continue to represent because hip hop is new still, you know. It's new. It's the newest form of music right now. And it's the most popular form of music. And its story hasn't been told all the way yet. And we could continue to tell it.
You know, in your new album, you have a song called Fisherman, which it talks about glamorizing prison life, glamorizing sex, drugs, gangs, things of that sort.
So many black youth locked in a box for life, for life. It wasn't worth the sacrifice.
Do you feel like the informational aspect or style that you guys approached hip hop with is still being translated correctly in today's version of hip hop?
No, I think there's a lack of that particular substance. Hip hop is more flooded with, you know, the chase of money, the enjoyment of drugs, the enjoyment of sex, the gang. You know, a lot of, you know, gangs are back, you know, even, you know, all over the country. And it's understandable because young men, we passed through that. But what hip hop was in the original, it was actually, it was anti-gang. You know, it was a way to the express violence without being physical. It wasn't something that was made to make money from. It was something made to entertain us because of lack of money. You know what I mean? The artist didn't have canvases in his house and paintbrushes. He had a can, a spray paint, and the subway trains and the walls became his canvases because that's all that was available. The lyricist and the poet didn't have a place where he could go and be at a poetry lounge or perform on stage and none of that. The stage was the block parties. You know what I mean? The dancers didn't have Alvin Ailey schools and Broadway. You know what I mean? The concrete and the cardboard was the place. So hip hop was these things, and it grew, of course, and it became economical, and it became a place where some people could express drugs and sex, but it also had KRS-One's, you know, Big Daddy Kane's and Rakim, you know, Shabazz. It had a balance, so you could dance with the Jungle Brothers, but you could get some Afrocentric knowledge from Tribe Called Quest. You know what I mean? And so I think we're lacking that substance. In order for me to even put music out, which I'm doing here, I'm really giving it away to say, like, yo, here go a spoonful of that. And the best I could wish for is that a hip-hop artist hears it and get inspired and start bringing that substance back. For me, one thing I've learned is that sometimes Wu-Tang is for the artist community, sometimes not the fan community. It's just for, like, somebody else to hear it and go, okay, let me add that to mine. I forgot about that, Riz. Thanks. You know?
Man, that's so deep. Tell me what you're trying to get across in your music now.
Well, like I said, just adding a spoonful of substance and a spoonful of fun. Me and DJ Scratch, you know, a legendary hip-hop producer. We communicated with each other during the quarantine. I checked on him and his family, and then, you know, it's everything as well. Then I spoke to him about this old beat that he had in his catalog, and does he still have it? He said, yes. I said, I've been feeling really lyrical now. I want to write an album. He said, yo, I got a lot of tracks that I made, like, with the Wu-Tang in mind. I said, well, send them to me, and he sent them to me. And what we wanted to do collectively, we wanted to kind of give that feeling that we had when we was young, which was in New York City, at 3 o'clock on Saturdays, they had Kung Fu Theater on Channel 5. And we would all go upstairs, leave, you know, I don't care if you was a hustler, a break dancer, playing basketball, you would go upstairs and the whole projects would be cleared out. And everybody be up in the crib watching the Kung Fu movies and then come back out after it was over and start flipping and making nunchucks out of our mom's boomsticks and you know, just emulating what we saw. And it was actually joyful and inspirational. And so this album is hopefully can do that. And also information. You know, it was for us, you know, we didn't know what Shaolin was or the culture of China and Chinese brothers and the chivalry and honor, you know, and watching, you know, look at Bruce Lee fighting oppression. There's a scene where it says no dogs or Chinese allowed. And he broke that sign. You know what I mean? You think about, you know, we are just a second generation away from can't drink from the water fountain. You know what I mean? And so that those heroic natures resonated with us. And we wanted to make an album that kind of just bring you back to that, have some fun. And lyrically, if you hear some of my lyrics, I am, you know, I'm saying certain things that definitely have political context. I think I said despotism, socialism, capitalism, communism, forgot the wisdom. So we sitting in a rotten system. Huh. All these isms is useless without wisdom. And I went on to say, left, right, come together. You know what I mean? Just bring the left and right together, form this W, put your hands up, Wu-Tang is forever. You know what I mean? Huh. So... yeah.
Tie it all back together.
Yeah. So I think it's healthy. I think it's the vegetables of the day.
Well, look, man, I'm a fan of your music. I listened to the new album. I think it's dope. And even more importantly, man, I think you are an incredible, enlightening human being who continues to need to shine to spread your wisdom, because your words today have moved me in ways, man, I can't even explain. So I wanted to say thank you. I appreciate you, RZA, so much for what you've done for your community, for our community, and for our listeners here today, man. I appreciate you, brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. Respect. Peace.
A huge thank you to RZA and his whole team for making this conversation go down. His album with DJ Scratch is called Saturday Afternoon Kung Fu Theater. It's a dope listen, trust me. And there's so much more from our conversation that's dropping this Thursday in the Limits Plus feed. Like how RZA learned to reject white colonialist views of his people, and some thoughts for his friend Kanye West on how to preserve his own legacy. Hit that link in the description of this episode to subscribe. The Limits is produced by Karen Kinney, Mano Sundaresan, Lena Sansgiri, Barton Gerwood, Brent Bachman, Rachel Neal, Yolanda Sanguini. Our executive producer is Anya Grundman. Music by Ramteen Arab Louie. Special thanks to Charlotte Riggi and Edward Wyckoff Williams. I'm Jay Williams. Let's stay positive and keep it moving.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2X miles on everything you buy. Plus, get access to a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.